everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Yeah. And this is episode number 65.
So many episodes.
Yeah, so many episodes.
I love it.
You bet, me too. We're going to talk about Kirin Yaga by Mike Resnick. It's a, I guess you call it a fix-up novel. Is that the right definition of that?
Oh, is there a term for that?
I think there is. That's when they take a string of short stories and publish it as a novel.
And Martian Chronicles the first fix-up novel?
I don't know. It might be. I don't know if it's the first. It's
probably not the first. Definitely one of them.
I know Isaac Asimov's I, Robot.
Oh, right.
I don't know if they ever call that a novel, though, but there's...
Oh,
you know,
I think
some,
so.
Linking material added in there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But this one is interesting because when you get to the end, he actually talks about the process he went through because he planned it to be a novel, but he planned to do it as a series of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astounded to see how many awards each one of these stories individually won.
Yeah, it really was surprising. You know, I came across it when I was reading through a list of Hugo-winning short stories. I used to have a column that I used to write. Well, it was two incarnations. I had a website, and then I had a column for, I forget the name of the thing. It was about it was called The Fix, I think.
Okay.
Anyway, so that was a kind of an online journal that I was writing for. And... anyway, Kirin Yaga was the first one to pop up on my list, and I read that, and then I realized, whoa, this other one is from the same thing, so I just got the whole book, and I read the whole book, and really blew me away. You know, it was one of those things where you're like, wow, this is really hitting deep themes, but at the same time, you know, I didn't really know how I felt about it for a while. I knew that it triggered a lot of deep thought in me.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't tell yet whether it was good or bad, you know. It's like, you know, is this author, is he trying to put religion down? Or is he just trying to bring some thought to light, you know? And it really doesn't make any difference what the author's intention is in this case. You know, that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But because this main character does things... incorrectly sometimes. And but yet it spurs a lot of the religious thought, like I was saying.
Oh brother, does it? It's called A Fable of Utopia. So right there it starts to show we're dealing with a big theme. And I was interested because I've read two or three of Mike Resnick's. He's got a space pirate series.
Oh, yeah.
Which I enjoyed very much. But if it dealt with big themes, it was not super deeply, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe somebody will correct me. But I didn't feel it. And then I've read a few of his short stories. And I read one for Escape Pod and that kind of thing. So I was used to thinking of him as a short story author primarily who... writes these very good, entertaining stories or, you know, novels, but not that deep. And so Kirin Yaga was kind of an interesting choice, I thought. And I read it and went, well, holy crap, the man's been holding out on me. I hadn't been reading the right thing because this was an impressive book.
Yeah,
I
thought so too.
Fascinated.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Before we move on, he's got two other stories that are really worth finding that aren't part of the Kirin Yaga series, but still kind of deal with the same themes in a way.
Okay.
Big themes in a short fiction. One is called Seven Views of Olduvai Gorge.
That's one that I keep seeing mentioned, and I wanted to look for it.
Really terrific. And then The 43 Antarian Dynasties is another one of his stories that I really like.
Huh, I've never heard of that one.
Yeah.
Maybe I just don't read the right list.
Yeah, but yeah, both worth checking out. And I think clearly the Seven Views of Olduvai Gorge came from the same time of Mike Resnick's life. You know, I guess he visited Africa a few times, and that's an African story as well, although it's not a Kirinyaga story. And then the 43 Antarian dynasties, I think, also was inspired by that same thing, although it doesn't take place in Africa. It's kind of about some tourists visiting an alien place, and the guide kind of being disrespected, not on purpose, by these tourists.
I have read that story.
Yeah.
I believe, because it's very reminiscent of people who would visit Egyptian.
Exactly.
I have read that story, which I remember enjoying and thinking about.
I like it a bit.
This book is fascinating because, since he wrote it with one end in mind, although all independent, it's obviously following a big theme. But I know that when we got to the end of the book, I went, what? Whoa, wait, what happened just now? And I had to go back and look at the story. And each story starts with a Kikuyu people, if that's how you say it, people's story of Ngai, which is God and man dealing together. Or doesn't it usually?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then in each story, usually, there's some other traditional story, or maybe one that this main protagonist tells, which deals with the people themselves and either how they deal with each other or how they're solving some problem. And it's in an unusual setting, and the character winds up with unusual movement of his life. And I was really surprised. That's when I suddenly thought about Mike Resnick and went, I'm not sure that he thinks the way I think he thinks. Because most of the story is definitely questioning religion and tradition, albeit through the actions of people to try and very dedicatedly follow tradition.
So the distant view of the book is about a man named Kariba who wants to build a utopia on this platform in space, basically. There seem to be a number of these platforms, and you can...
Oh, I thought it was a planet.
No, because...
I didn't read it carefully.
Yeah, because the maintenance people can adjust the orbit of this thing. So it seems to be some kind of an actual man-made thing.
I wondered how that worked.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there seems to be a number of these, but you really don't hear about what's going on the other ones. All you know is that, you know, people are living society. They call them other utopias at one point. So, you know, apparently people are experimenting with that, you know, however. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Kariba wants to, his idea of utopia is to revert a society, or have a society called the Kikuyu Society, which does these traditional Kikuyu things, you know, which basically means, you know, it's all tribal, I guess. I'm trying to think of how to describe it. But the idea of the book is that he's trying to create this utopia on a platform in space, which is separate from the Earth now.
Yeah, well, the idea is that he feels that once the Europeans came, that perverted all of what the Kikuyu people were supposed to be with their foreign influences, and that before then, they were living the way that Ngai, God, had dictated for them to live, and this is what would bring them to their fullest flourishing as a people. And he wasn't thinking of like a Renaissance like Europeans would, but he was just thinking, they will live in the way that they were meant to live, and this is what will make them the happiest and best they can be. And so when it starts, since I've described this book to numerous people, by the way, Scott, going, you have to read this book. It's amazing. So thank you for choosing it.
Good.
But basically, yeah, everything is so polluted on Earth, and everything's being used. So there is no more savanna on Earth. It's all been turned over for growing crops.
Yeah, things like elephants and things are extinct.
Extinct.
Although the Wikipedia entry says that it's a terraformed planetoid, so you may be right. I don't know why I had a platform in my head, but
I think because they kept talking about adjusting the
that's one of the things that maintenance, you know,
stuff.
With a capital M, there's people called maintenance.
Right.
And the way that he would do the seasons, you know, and I say he, meaning Kariba, was you know, in charge of this place. He would tell maintenance, you know, to adjust the orbit to make it warmer or cooler, you know, or whatever to make the seasons.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so he and this Kariba is a brilliant man. He's been educated. Everybody keeps mentioning when they're objecting to him wanting to live like this, they keep saying, but you have 2 degrees from, you know, I can't remember, like Dartmouth and Yale or various places that are very impressive. How can you be like this? And he is determined that life for them, just for that people, needs to be lived by their ancient customs. And so he gets about 200 people who are willing to go and do this. And he becomes their witch doctor. And they're living in these little villages. They're doing all the things that the people used to do. And a number of them are disturbing to consider in light of how we think you mm-hmm. should live, which is brilliant of Resnick to kind of hold that up against what's tradition versus what's right or wrong, such as the girls are all circumcised when they get to a certain age. The if a baby is born feet first, it's a demon, and therefore it needs to be killed. And even though he is European educated, he's like, well, this is the custom. This is what it means. And mm-hmm. they, you know, well, I'm sorry I strangled that baby, but there you go. Actually, I'm not sorry. It was a demon.
Yeah.
And they keep saying, can you really believe this? And he goes, it doesn't matter. It's our tradition.
Right.
So you see that in all these stories, what you're looking at is where is tradition valuable? Where is it something that needs to be thought about more? And it's not usually presented that way. It comes up in the situations that Kariba encounters as a witch doctor. And one of the first things you see is he himself is not living by tradition. I just want to bring this up because he'll go out and cast his bones going, oh, I think it's going to rain. And then he'll go back in and tell maintenance, can you adjust the orbit because it needs to adjust something because we need rain.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, you cheater.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway.
That makes, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, well, what the heck was his motives throughout this whole thing? You know, it's just interesting to think about.
Well, he talks always about wanting the people to be closer to Nagai,
mm-hmm.
to what God wants. And I think he feels that by doing what God wants, they'll be closer to him. And I think that's indicated by the last story most.
Sure. You mean the epilogue or the last story? I guess the epilogue is a story.
The one where he goes up the mountain.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's the epilogue.
Since we spoiled all kinds of things already. And I do want to say mm-hmm. That if you are just listening to see if you want to read the book, the fact that I mentioned strangling a baby is what kept me from reading this book for a long time, because that was what intrigued Jesse Willis from SFF Audio, who first spoke of it in glowing terms to me. And it's like, and then this happens. And he's just fascinated by the whole conundrum, which is fascinating. But I was like, what, I'm going to read story after story about stuff like this? I don't think so. I don't want to read it that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And that actually, he starts off with one of the most shocking instances, but then it very soon settles into more traditional short story forms of considering how you're living, why you make the choices you make, such as when there's a young girl who is just brilliant, and she has a searching soul, I think you'd have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And she discovers that there is such a thing as reading. There are such things as computers. And she's denied all that because that's not what women do.
Yeah, yeah.
And she says, I'm perfectly willing to live that life. I'm ready to, you know, get married and have many strong children and do the farming or whatever it is. But why can't I do this too? And he says, no, you can't do that because that's not your nature. That's not the nature of a woman. And she says, no, now I'm like a caged bird. It was a very poignant story.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. The you know, in the first story, Kirin Yaga, which is the first one after the prologue, that's when, you know, very early on in the story, I'll just read this paragraph just to set the scene. But it says, maintenance watches Kirin Yaga discreetly, making minor orbital adjustments when necessary, assuring that our tropical climate remains constant. From time to time, they have subtly suggested that we might wish to draw upon their medical expertise, or perhaps allow our children to make use of their educational facilities. But they have taken our refusal with good grace, and have never shown any desire to interfere in our affairs, until I strangled the baby. And then that's the scene, you know, that you set there. A baby was born feet first, and according to their tradition, that means that it's demonic, and he took care of it by strangling it. And then maintenance is just the word that means, you know, this is sort of the people that run all these platforms or planetoids, and they had to step in at that point because, you know, that's completely against their morality, right?
Yeah, you can't have people going around strangling babies.
Exactly. So the maintenance actually shows up on the you know, on Kirin Yaga, which is the name he gave this, you know, this planetoid or whatever. And anyway, that was just a fascinating discussion to me. I mean, here he was. He was completely unbending. And he said, this is just what we have to do. And in fact, you know, again, I know I'm spoiling the story, but he said that some, were there twins actually born? I'm trying to remember exactly. Because twins, also in their tradition, if they're twins, one of them needs to be eliminated. And I think at the very end of the story, he was saying, well, we're just going to have to do it. We're going to have to eliminate one.
The chief, because the other interesting conversation is with the chief of the village, because all the people who came out there know that they know how life is on Earth, and they know no one's going to want that to happen. And I found it interesting. Nobody seemed to object to him strangling the baby. And they gave him such authority because then they're like, okay, that wasn't smart. Maintenance is going to come down. And also, I'm kind of worried because we know somebody in the next village over or whatever is going to have twins, and you're going to have to kill the first one because one woman can't produce two souls. And I'm like, seriously, people? But what happens is then the chief says, well, you know, maybe we don't need to leave our old people and our infirm out for the hyenas to eat. And that's so right. You see how thoroughly they're adopting all these methods of living. And, well, maybe there's some medicine. That, and he's like, well, that is a slippery slope. The first time you do that is the first time that we start becoming European. And I thought it was interesting that the only reason the chief objected was because of maintenance to the children being killed. But right before that, it says, to be thrown out of paradise, as were the Christian Adam and Eve, is a terrible fate. But to live beside a debased paradise is infinitely worse. I think about them frequently, the descendants of Gikuyu, who have forgotten their origin and their traditions and are now merely Kenyans. And I wonder why more of them did not join us when we created the utopian world of Kirin Yaga. True, it is a harsh life, for Nagai never meant life to be easy, but it is also a satisfying life. And then he talks about the simple pleasures and these various things. And I thought at that point, and this story really makes you think about, when do you follow tradition versus what everybody else knows, and when is it just unbending stubbornness?
This one story alone, I mean, if you take this story just you know, out of context of the rest of the book, you know, just raises so many incredible questions, you know.
Well, because there is a natural tendency as Catholics to look at this with a great deal of interest because our faith stresses tradition with a capital T, as opposed to the customs that people just do. Because, like, I'm trying to think, tradition with a lowercase t in the Catholic Church is things like, I don't know, the vestments that priests wear or whatever. Those can be changed depending on some other decision. But the capital T tradition are things like, you know, Christ is that right? Christ is the Son of God. That's a teaching that has come down to us before the Bible was even born. We're not going to give that up. You know?
Right.
And so people will look at the Catholic Church a lot of times and feel that we're as unbending as Kariba. for instance, over, say, the government wanting us to pay for insurance so that people can have contraception. Mm-hmm. Wow, you're awfully unbending. That doesn't really hurt anyone. It's kind of hard on those poor young women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because they don't understand more of the underlying idea of you're denying life and God's participation in your marriage or whatever. Well, I kept looking for that in Kariba. I kept looking for what are the underlying reasons for all this besides its tradition and God said it. Because yeah. Catholics don't just have, I mean, we have a rich understanding. The Catholics have been thinking and writing and talking about this stuff for 2,000 years.
Yeah, no question. And you're hitting right on kind of the impact that this book had the first time that I read it.
Yeah.
It was, okay, I'm Catholic, and I'm looking at this, and the question, if I had to distill it to one question, is what is the difference between what Kariba is doing and what I'm doing as a Catholic? Meaning, I'm talking about it the most basic sense. You know, I'm not killing babies that are born feet first. But right. I'm just saying that there's, why is his religion different from mine? And why is mine valid and his not? These are fundamental questions that leap to mind, you know, that the book makes me think about. Because, you know, there's a line, you know, here in the United States, clearly, you know, we've got a secular government. You know, they're trying to make it more and more secular as time goes on.
Right.
And, you know, you've got religions, you know, like us that want to be able to live how we feel like we should be able to live. And that's what Kariba is asking at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Although, and you pointed out exactly, you know, things like, you know, well, we don't really want to pay for contraception as a rule. And why should we have to do that, you know, when our religion is against it? And I feel that people that are outside these traditions, they look at Kariba and Pope Francis in this exact same way.
Right.
To them, they're equal. There's no difference.
And the difference that I saw between one of the first notes I made was this thing about being thrown out of paradise is a terrible fate, but to live beside a debased paradise is infinitely worse. And I was like, Kariba's attitude this way is, let's go away and make a utopia for ourselves because we can't coexist. There's no way to adapt. It's completely opposite from the Catholic way, which for, was it 1600 years, was the Christian way. I mean, you know, more or less.
Sure, yeah.
But because, and St. Francis de Sales said it really well in a book we read earlier, Introduction to the Devout Life, when he said, God maintains the world in existence in a state of continual change.
Yeah.
We know everything's not the same everywhere you go. We know everybody's customs aren't the same. But what we do is, instead of going, here's this one way to do everything, there are some unyielding traditions because those are actually truths, capital T truths. And every truth that is discovered is one that Catholics celebrate because God is equals truth. Truth is what God is. And so that shows us another facet of God. And that's why you have so many Catholic scientists like Gregor Mendel, you know, father of genetics, or Lemaître, who discovered the Big Bang. You know, these are, you couldn't have that if you weren't interested in knowing how things work.
Yeah, and it is interesting, you know, when you think about it, you know, there are Christian sects that, you know, don't want their kids having medicine, you know,
right.
and things like that. And, you know, the Catholic faith is not one of those.
Mm-mm.
You know, it's embraced, it's encouraged, you know, the discovery and all that stuff is encouraged. And I think that that's necessary, but yet we're still lumped with everybody else.
Well, you know, because
it's like, you know, the Catholic faith has everything. Every single time that I look into some aspect of the Catholic faith that I haven't looked into before, I'm really surprised by it. I don't know why I still am, but I do. and things like that. You know, when I look at this book, you know, one of the main differences is, you know, we don't do anything that is objectionable in these ways.
Right. We're about life is precious.
Yeah. And we're embracing, you know, as Christianity spread, you know, when Christianity embraces change and embraces the traditions that it found, you know, in countries that, you know, like Ireland, for example. I think I've talked about mm-hmm. this before, where mm-hmm. you can contrast the Christianity being brought to the Irish with the Christianity being brought in the Americas, and right. how one of them was done correctly and one of them wasn't. So, but yet, you know, again, you know, when you look at the Catholic faith, you know, there are people that do things incorrectly, but you always know what the right thing is. And when it's done that way, things are really pretty good.
Well, it's like a society mm-hmm. in general. You look at a society and say, if you look back 200 or 300 years or whatever, you look at American society. Wow, this is right. These things, wrong. You mm-hmm. know, it was great that America was founded, or the U.S. was founded on, you know, the principles of democracy, and look what they did and how the immigrants were treated oftentimes. Terrible. But that was a lot of people making a wrong decision. And it's been corrected. Slavery, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had to have a civil war to stop it. Yeah. But we were at least eventually trying to do the right thing. And when you look at Catholicism, any institution that's 2,000 years old is going to have all kinds of instances where people went off track. But the big question is, was it corrected for eventually? You know, mm-hmm. And the other thing, though, that occurred to me is, one of the things that I was fascinated by is a story that comes later on where young men begin committing suicide. Mm. And they have to do it by going out and letting the hyenas eat them, and in horrible ways like this. And so when Kariba starts investigating, what he finds is these young men are in a state of depression and despair because there is nothing for them to do except live in this utopia, so to speak, without any kind of personal challenge. And so they're like, could we please have some Maasai come live here too, so we can go steal wives from them and we can fight them off and give us something so that we can have some sense of self-worth, essentially? And he's like, oh, no, that's not how things were designed. God didn't want that. Well, they were invaders. So he's trying to keep it so pure, so original. He's got no allowance for adaptation. And eventually those people, the only thing he can offer, because he is an imperfect person who can't think of anything better, is to shun them. When these brilliant young men are discovered, they have to go live as outsiders, and therefore their very struggle for existence becomes the challenge that they desire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so different from the way the Catholic Church handles things.
Yeah, and it really is. You know, if you equate, like, the Pope with Kariba, for example, that's not how the Pope operates. You know, I've mm-hmm. been explaining a lot of Pope stuff to a class that I'm doing. And, you know, that's not how the Pope is. You know, everybody always brings up infallibility. Well, here at Kariba, this is an example of someone who thinks that he's got the infallible right. information, right? But even so, that's not how the Pope operates. You know, if infallibility is invoked, it's not in isolation, for one thing. You know, Pope Francis is not going to declare something completely different from what's come before. I mean, he's one of the bishops, right? So, I mean, it's an entire, there's a whole lot that would go into that. It's not just him just waking up in the morning and saying, you know what, God told me that this is so, and we need to make that so now.
We must all just wear one left shoe.
Yeah, exactly. and that's just not how it is.
Yeah. And a lot of times, what's kind of interesting when you start looking into papal infallibility, and not only what has to go into something being considered that way, is for one thing, it's only about things to do with the church's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that a lot of times what it reflects is something that the church population, the lay people, already know and feel deeply.
Yeah, exactly.
Such as Mary being declared the mother of God.
Right. And that's a tradition with a capital T, right?
Right.
It's something that everybody has known, but has never been really just declared and said, this is so.
Well, because usually the only reason those things have to be declared and written down is because it's been challenged by something, a heresy that's arisen. So it's a wrong teaching that's leading people astray. And up until then, no one had to say it. Yeah. And think of some of the laws we have now where it's like, or some of the things like, you know, you'll look at your lawnmower and you'll see some of these ridiculous stickers on it. Don't do this and don't do that. Well, until somebody won a lawsuit of injuries, huge injury payments being made because they tried to use their lawnmower to trim their hedges and they got the award, no lawnmower company had to put anything on it saying this is only designed for cutting grass or whatever. Everyone knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you have to make these labels because somebody has come up and done something so ridiculous that you just go, oh, okay, fine. And that's how that's the reason for these papal infallibility statement or statements that are considered infallible. And that's why there are so few of them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And the other thing that gets me is until the very end of the book where it's represented that, oh, once people start learning facts and you know, actual information, and then the religious guy loses all his power, no one ever questions him. And I'm thinking, but all those original colonists, they knew everything. They decided to go along with this. He acts like, in that story, it's acted like, oh, no one knew this stuff before.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know,
and
that
so that's kind of a
called,
flaw.
Yeah,
that
a little
story.
Knowledge, right. And Demi, who he's training to be his successor,
right?
Once he's given access to the computer, the maintenance computer that is used to bring rain or whatever he wants, and Demi starts to question everything. He's like, you know, why can't we do this? You know, this Kirinyaga, the word isn't even a Kikuyu word. It's, you know, I mean, just things like that. Just question after question after question, and the whole thing just crumbles.
And he's ill-equipped to deal with it. Wait, I forgot his
Kariba.
Name.
Yeah.
Kariba, because the story is told, all the stories are told first person, so you don't hear his name very often.
Sure, yeah.
But here's the other thing that kind of comes to me out of our discussion right at the moment is most of the people I know, well, we all do this because we can't absorb all the information. But if you're curious about something, you say, why is it those silly whatever, pick a group, do it like this? Well, if you don't look into it any further, you're accepting the sound bites that the media gives you. I know a lot of people who think Christians are ridiculous or that I'm an unusual Christian because I actually think, you know, and I'm like, you know what? There's lots of smart Christians out there. Why aren't the people who are accepting these ridiculous stereotypes asking more questions or asking even what books should I read or looking deeper instead of just knee-jerk accepting what's told and then going, oh, you don't live up to this stereotype that I have because I'm not thinking of it as a stereotype? Because they're smart people usually. The ones that I run into or meet that are like this, why don't they ask a question? Why don't they ever ask? Why do they just accept this stuff? How many labels do we put on people that we just go along with and then think, oh, these two people I know, they're exceptions to the rule.
Hmm.
You know, that's really kind of, it's insulting to me and it's insulting to the people themselves, because I know, and I'm talking about people I meet in everyday life. I mean,
sure,
you know, people
I work. Yeah, I come across the same thing. I remember many conversations where I've had with somebody who thought that Christianity was a certain thing, and, you know, well, clearly you don't believe this, or, you know, you're against global warming, or whatever it might be. You know, or you know, you don't believe in that stuff, but it's just like, oh, you know, come on, people. You know, that's, you know, it, and it is, it's, you know, the coverage of the Pope is something that's just so clearly illustrates what you're talking about.
Man.
Because they, you know, he'll say something and then, you know, it'll be plastered all over everything. And along with the interpretation, it's not just what he says, but it's an interpretation of what he says and how different it is from what came before, for example.
And it hasn't been,
you know, if we're talking about Pope Francis specifically,
right?
He says a lot of things, but he's not changing anything. And what he says is not new. It's, you know, it's been, you know, environmentalism is one thing. I remember somebody told me, he said, "Oh, I really respect Pope Francis because I think he'll be an environmentalist." And I'm like,
unlike every other pope.
Yeah, like, you know, I think Pope John Paul wrote something on environment. Yes. Didn't Benedict write something as well?
Well, and every World Day, they give a homily that talks about the need of man to tend to creation, because this is God's creation, too.
Yeah, so
we're here as the stewards of it. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, that's just an illustration. So they're portraying this out of a certain bias that, you know, just colors what they write.
Well, and here's the thing. The people who usually... what is reported might be one sentence that then is interpreted in all these various ways. And mm-hmm. a good illustration is Pope Francis recently was on a flight back from World Youth Day in Brazil, and he was answering reporters' questions, which, you know, just always like, oh, really? Don't do that. Because here you go. He, you know, Pope Francis doesn't know why gays can't become priests or something like this. And, you know, all of a sudden this is all over the news. And when you start looking back, which is what I did, I was like, well, and very true, and depending on circumstances, you know, but he got, and they're like, so unlike Pope Benedict, that cold, intellectual, unyielding. And I'm like, wow, Wall Street Journal, you're really, you know, this is about the fourth story by this one person where I'm just going, wow, do you just hate the Catholic Church, or do you not realize how many labels I'm seeing in story after story? And I brought it up to my husband, who went, yeah, I don't know if it's an editor or that person, but they have it in for the church. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and started looking for, where's the whole text of what he said? Oh, it's right there on the internet. You can find it. And when I read it, the question was about a gay lobby that had been formed in the Vatican, or to go to the Vatican and demand certain things. And he answered the gay lobby about gay people in general. And then he answered about the gay lobby. Mm-hmm. And they kind of took all that and twisted it all together so that you weren't reading the correct thing. And people who would say, oh, my favorite politician couldn't have said that, and they'll go look for it. They won't ever go look for it on, oh, that goes along with what I think perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, which is something that I myself have to fight doing for, say, maybe the political party I don't approve of. But it's kind of a lesson to me of, don't just accept those sound bites from anyone.
Yeah.
Everything go to the is source, more nuanced for sure. than you think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go to the source. And so many people don't do that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we kind of got way off track of the story
no,
in a
but
sense.
It's all connected, and that's the thing. It's all, you know, this whole, you know, building of a utopia around an idea, and then the unbending of that idea, and, you know, it is reflective of society. It's almost an extreme, you know, so Kariba can be seen as an extreme example of mm-hmm. what a lot of people think the Pope is, for example. You know, that's the way that I felt when I was reading it. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not, it's just, it was really interesting to me in that way. And over, I mean, it hit all kinds of things, you know, like how does knowledge affect a religion, you know, as, mm-hmm. you know, and change, you brought up change. And then the whole idea of a utopia in the first place, you know, it occurred to me on this reading, you know, because I'm reading World War Z kind of at the same time, I'm listening to it. You know, there's a reason why, you know, these zombie novels and things are interesting to me. And one of them is the fact that, you know, societies are being built from nothing. You know, we're being stripped to bare necessity. And what comes out of that, you know, good and bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good that we don't have to go to work at 7 a.m, but it's bad that, you know, we have to run every day. You know what I mean?
So, well, and the stand.
Yeah.
Covered that really well.
Exactly, it did. So it made me think, you know, if you have a small town somewhere that is predominantly a certain religion, and then all of a sudden all of that civilization was stripped away, you know, what would happen? You know, what would a Catholic utopia be? You know, I think that the point is, yeah, exactly. I think that a lot of people would have a different answer for that. If you're talking about an earthly society in a small town, I think that it's natural for, you know, one of the thoughts that occurred to me was I think it's natural for people to be distrusting of anybody who's not what they are. And in a place where you're threatened, you know, there's no civilization, I think that persecution would be something that would, it would be hard to fight.
A Catholic utopia would be the relate, because I was thinking what you would want is a place where you can practice your Catholicism fully, but you're not keeping other people away from what they need to do, because Catholics are all about, it's a personal relationship with God. The church is there to facilitate that and help get you to heaven. But everybody's at different points on that journey. And so really, of gods and men, before the extremists come in, that little Muslim town and the monastery would be a utopia. Yes, they have to struggle for existence, but look how they enjoy each other's company. They can accept each other for who they all are. They make each other's lives better and happier. That, to me, would be a heaven on earth.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think that that's a really good point. But, and, you know, the idea that he brings up here that utopia is, can only be momentary. It's like, you know, has the United States ever hit like a utopian status at any point in their history? We're certainly not there right now. I think some people would argue that the, you know, the period directly after World War II was a type of utopia. I realize, you know, there was racism and a lot of things. A lot of people would not agree.
But I was going to say, unless you were black.
Exactly.
Or,
yeah. But a lot of people would say, hey, we really, you know, we really nailed something right around that time that, that, you know, this was some kind of a peak experience for the United States in some way. But again, like I said, you know, I agree with you that there's a lot of people that would argue that, and rightly.
Well,
but, you know, has there been a time, you know, in history even, you know, it's just really interesting to think about.
No.
Because Kariba has a certain idea, and it's really his idea. And he's bringing all these people along, and it's just, it's odd to me. You know, it's almost like he's thinking about his own utopia. He's not thinking about other people. And he brings these other people with him, and he's unbending. But he's not... It's almost his idea that he wants to stick to. He's not thinking about, well, is this utopia for everyone else as well?
And that's the point that not only do the stories make, but maintenance, the representative from maintenance makes it early on when she's saying, "Your part of your charter says that if anyone wants to leave, they can leave. That baby, that newborn baby you strangled, didn't get a choice."
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't bother to try to answer. And then she says, "I'm 40 and childless. I would have loved to take that baby. There are many other women in my situation. We would take any of these babies you don't want." And he's like, "Nope, not our tradition." So he's very closed off, you're right, to any ideas. And at one point, one of the characters says, "There's a difference between tradition and stagnation." And then later on, somebody else says, "All living things change or they die."
Mm-hmm.
And so any man-made idea of utopia has got to take in that idea of change. But the idea of utopia itself is you reach this point of perfection and then you've got it. You don't change. And I think one of the weaknesses of these stories, when they're taken as a book, there are individuals who question things. And that's where the interesting tension comes from, whether they're trying to dominate this society or whether they're trying to express themselves and the society doesn't allow them to. But, oh shoot, I lost my train of thought. Well, anyway, the thing I was going to say is that what Catholics know is you're never going to have utopia here. And then Tolkien has a letter, J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, says in a letter, and this is a paraphrase, but I love it. He says, "Well, I'm a Christian and indeed a Catholic, so I know there is going to be no final victory on earth, although we can see glimpses and hints of the final victory that will be achieved overall. So, but what he knew was you have to try. You can't give up. You have to do what you can to make your bit of the world a good place, a better place, utopia as much as you can, even though it's kind of that fatal scratch on our the masterpiece that is humans, as Peter Kreeft puts it, that original sin puts in, is that flaw that we keep making the wrong decisions. But the point is that we keep getting up and trying to fix what we've done. If that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, sure does.
You always move towards the greater good. You always try to consider other people first. You always go for life instead of death, because each person has part of Christ in them. And that's, you honor that. That's what makes life so precious. And not just because of Christ, but that's a huge motivator for Christians. You look at that and you go, look at what Christ went through. He is us. He went through everything we go through.
Mm-hmm.
How can I not help someone else?
Yeah.
So he, God himself, if you look at it just even from an outside point of view, if you've got a teaching that God himself came down and went through all this stuff to show us how it should be, well, you try to do it, man. And he went around helping people like crazy. He cried when he saw his friend dead. He, you know. How can you not try to make life a utopia? But you don't do it by imposing draconian rules on people that don't consider everyone else's humanity in addition to what you yourself want. And that's what Kariba is doing. And I think that's the point I got off track on.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting thoughts, you know. Now, how does that affect the religion encroaching on politics? Like making decisions, you know, like in politics, making decisions based on the fact that, you know, this is how the Catholic way, for example. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, you know, if you were a Catholic, politician, would you fight to make sure that euthanasia was not legal, or things like of that nature?
I guess let me ask it like this. If you have a politician who's been voted in based on what they say is true, and you agree that's true also, do you not expect them to fight for that truth to be adequately represented?
I would, yeah.
And therefore, if Catholics' teachings are based not just on a, well, dogma's got a bad word, a bad name, but dogma just means, you know, the teachings of the church. If you really believe that it's true that every life is precious and that dying is a process, as long as not somebody's not in excessive pain, that dying is a process needed to help them be at peace when they go, to help them be ready for the next world, do you not fight to give each person that dignity that is due to them simply by their inherent humanity? I think you have to.
I think you would have to.
Yeah, I
think that it's a case-by-case basis, to be honest.
Right,
You're talking about contraception, you know, as Catholics, you know, we don't encourage that use, right? But I cannot see a Catholic politician introducing, well, I'm sure it's probably happened, but as a rule, you know, because of the respect of humanity for everyone else, that's, we're not going to sit there and try and make that illegal. We just don't want to pay for it.
Right.
I mean, in what's going on in today's society, right?
We respect each person's choice. And if they're making what we would consider mistakes because they aren't adequately informed, what we would try to do is inform them.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's the point that Bishop Farrell has made on his homilies over and over, and I'm sure many others, on the Right to Life March days. He'll say, we hope that this rule about abortion would go away. He goes, but what really has to change is the truth that is in people's hearts, because then it wouldn't matter that we have that law that allows abortion. No one would choose it. So that's the idea behind things like those sonograms that different states would like to make mandatory, that each woman see a sonogram of the baby before she chooses an abortion. They're not trying to hide anything or force them to do anything. But what they want them to do is see, look right here. This is the reality of what you are carrying inside you. I'm sorry it's disturbing people who don't want you to see it because it looks just like a baby. Because guess what? It's a baby. Now you have all the truth. Make your choice. And so in that sense that, and I think I mentioned this last time, that Wendy Davis in the Texas legislature who did a filibuster about wanting to strike down an anti-abortion law, or it was a pro-life group or pro-life law that was being put through, and she didn't like it. I had to honor that lady. She believed in the truth that she believed, which, you know, I think was uninformed, but still, she's putting herself out there for it. Isn't that what you want your politicians to do?
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can't divorce who you are and where you grew up from what you're doing. And that's a Catholic politician. I wouldn't ask to do that any more than I would a Jewish politician or an atheist politician. Or a, what I ask is that they not impose their personal belief on the law, but let us all be able to live by the truth. I don't see people going around making rules that the Amish can't have to have zippers taken away.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares about zippers. They could do what they want.
Sure.
But everybody's willing to do that about, you know, pushing the Catholics around right now.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that sounds paranoid, but look at the facts.
Yeah. That's all really interesting. You know how surprised, you know, I haven't been following politics that closely this year.
I've been trying not to.
And you know how surprised I was when I found out, you know, I even not following things very much, I knew that there was a big hubbub about an abortion bill in Texas, right? So yeah. Imagine my surprise when I found out that the bill said, you know, you can have an abortion up to 20 weeks.
Yeah.
20 weeks. I mean, that I was really surprised. I said, this fight, I mean, heck, you know, after 20 weeks, a baby can be born and survive.
And right.
You know? So it's just, I don't know. I mean,
well,
there's not a lot of people, you know, in common. We just don't have a lot of common ground. I don't understand why that's a problem. And they don't understand why it's a problem either. It's, you know, both sides are like,
right.
You know,
well, it's like Kariba. Mm-hmm. He has his one set idea and he's not willing to open up to any other way of thinking or think that adaptation could be a good thing. And I'm sorry. Maybe I sound like Kariba. I'm not talking about us.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the abortion people haven't got the same mutual ground for understanding that this is life. I mean, I just had a young couple who, the young man is a friend of our oldest daughter's, and he's, you know, I've known him throughout his high school years, and he's now married. They attend our church, and they brought their little baby up for us to see, who's now 6 months old. But developmentally, she's 3 months old because she was born 3 months early. They just now have gotten her healthy enough to the point that she can come out and be part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this little baby, best smile ever. You know, that kind of thing. We were invited to the baptism. What an honor. Mm-hmm. But it's that thing of that baby, if it had been an abortion, a mother who wanted an abortion and it was born alive early, they would have killed it or let it cry itself to death on a cold table by itself. That means that those people have lost their connection to what life means and what is our common humanity. You know, they're like Kariba. They're just looking at what are the rules. They're not looking at who all these people are.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people think the Catholic Church doesn't do, but it really does.
Yeah, and that's such a good point. You know, by comparing those folks to Kariba, I think that, you know, all too often a non-religious person would read this book and say, yeah, I mean, look at what Kariba is, right? Mm-hmm. When they don't see Kariba in themselves. You don't have to be religious to be like Kariba.
And I know we're running out of time, so I kind of wanted to look at the last story, because that story to me was one of the most challenging to understand, or the epilogue called The Land of Nod.
The Land of Nod, okay. And so Kariba returns to Earth.
Right.
Yep, go ahead.
Well, what happens is, as we mentioned, everybody has so much factual information that they all basically wrest control from Kariba by ignoring him.
Mm-hmm.
And they start making decisions of their own, and they start saying that, well, it is utopia. It's not the utopia you want, and utopia can evolve. Adios. And he's like, ugh. So he leaves, and he goes to stay with his son, and he's driving his son insane because he insists. And, you know, this is where you're just like, really, you are not trying at all. You know, he's doing things like digging up his lawn to make fire pits and, you know, wandering around in his robe and embarrassing them by living his traditional life no matter what. And he's found one person who is a sympathizer, an old man, because that old man was not brave enough to go off to Kirin Yaga. And so he regrets it. So they can both have that mutual bond of what life should be like. And this old man actually is taking care. He's the caretaker for an elephant that has been cloned from some ivory. And I was like, can that even happen? But whatever. Could any of this happen? And so, of course, you feel horrible for the elephant. And it's kind of, maybe it was just me who felt like, I get it. The elephant's Kariba. Okay. Because he's stuck in this very small enclosure. He's unhappy. He doesn't know what it is to be a real elephant. And he's kind of just a curiosity. And the only person he relates to at all is Kariba through, he doesn't hurt him. He's not dangerous to him. He'll eat peanuts from his hand, unlike with anybody else. And at the very end, they set the elephant free. They take him and let him go up the mountain, even though there's dangerous radiation from some leaking that's been going on from, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
By that point, I didn't care anymore about what was happening technically. It was kind of like Doctor Who and his sonic screwdriver. Okay, magic, done, and moving on.
You bet.
For the story. But, and so what happens is Kariba also goes up the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think, his friend doesn't want to go. His friend wants to stay. He kind of wants to go, but he would really rather stay with his family and all this kind of stuff. And so Kariba says, that's all right. And then he says, I have work to do, I thought, important work. And you would desert me in the end, as they have all deserted me. Better that you leave now. And so he goes up the mountain on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, I have wasted many years seeking Nagai on the wrong mountain. Men of lesser faith might believe him dead or disinterested, but I knew that if Ahmed, the elephant, could be reborn after all others of his kind were long dead, then Nagai must surely be nearby, overseeing the miracle. I will spend the rest of the days regaining my strength, and then in the morning I would begin searching for him again on Marsabit. And this time I knew I would find him. And I got done with that story and I went, what just happened? I'm very confused. And then I went back to the beginning little story that they always tell about God and men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a warrior who has always done the right things and he's always prayed. And then he's attacked by a leopard. And when he's attacked by the leopard, he's like, Nagai, save me. And he says, Nagai didn't save him. He got tossed into a tree and all this kind of stuff. And so then he's really pissed off at God. Mm-hmm. And so he goes up to the mountain and says, why didn't you come? All my life I've worshipped you and paid tribute to you. Did you not hear me ask for your help? I heard you, answered Nagai. Then why did you not come to my aid? Demanded the warrior. Are you so lacking in godly powers that you could not find me? After all these years, you still do not understand, said Nagai sternly. It is you who must search for me. And I was kind of left with, wow, in that essential story, Mike Resnick got it so right. And in another way, he got it so wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think the point is that he's just putting all this stuff out there, the contradictions, for us to consider ourselves. You don't know where he ends up on it. But we can't go around. And this was me. But at least it was a friendly bet when I was like, all right, God, prove you exist. Because in the end, God didn't come through with anything. Well, he did lavishly. But it was after I went, you know what? I don't have a reason to not believe. I'm just going to go ahead with it. And I didn't really ask for anything. And I'm not saying this to give myself credit. It's just where I was with it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I had to go to him. I had to say, I'm going to essentially submit to this. Although I didn't feel I was submitting. It was kind of like a handshake deal again. And that's when God went, and here I am, right here with you the whole time. But if you're so blind you can't see me, you can call and you can ask and you can do this stuff and you can demand. But if it's on your own standards, where's there room for God?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's what that last thing to me kind of meant, is he was trying to set everything up and live the way he thought he should, but that wasn't necessarily what God wanted. God created us to be one way, and this is me talking now, of course, not Mike Resnick, but that's what he's showing through these stories. All in all these ways, the people are breaking through because their own personalities don't fit this traditional model. Change is necessary. Change is life. And for him to control that, for Kariba to control the environment and everything just the way he wants, it doesn't allow life to spring forth in the way that God did. Even if you're just living on the savanna with all the animals, some years there's drought, some years there's rain, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
That's right. Yeah, that's amazing. Fascinating. Yeah, that's cool. Yep, I hadn't thought of that. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did it hit you then? I'm curious.
No,
because
I'm just talking about that specific thing. The thing is, this book has created so many questions in me. You know, I just didn't have that specific thing.
Okay.
I thought it was great. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really thought provoking, and I'm going to recommend it for my Catholic Women's Book Club.
Well, that's neat.
I think they would find it because it's very readable.
Mm-hmm. And it is. And it's a very good audiobook too, by the way. I think because it's readable, the audiobook is very easy to follow, and it's very well read too. I can't remember who read it, but this time I listened.
Yeah, and I have it, and I wanted to listen, but I just didn't have time. I took it on vacation with me. So I was going around Pittsburgh where I met Mike Aquilina.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
My gosh, he spent all day, 10 in the morning to 9:30 at night. But by the time I got done, I had mentioned the book to him, to his son, to Chris Bailey, who I don't know if you ever read Dr. Bowley's Celebrated Magazine.
Yeah, you told me about that, and I have since you told me. Yeah.
Between Mike Aquilina and Chris Bailey, you would get a tour of Pittsburgh like no other. They could go into business as specialized tour guides and possibly make a fortune.
That's excellent.
It was amazing. But I kept telling people about the book. And since I've gotten home, I've been telling people about this book because it is so interesting. It really is thought-provoking. And I think if you get through this book and you have said to yourself, all these people fit into all these slots, I know exactly what the author intended, I think you missed the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too.
He impressed me. I have always kind of liked him because he's not one of those guys who goes around pushing his thoughts on others, like some other science fiction authors where you know very clearly what they think about stuff. And I've read very little by him.
Mm-hmm.
But in what I've read, and this impressed me a lot. It was the work of a thoughtful person who's willing to let people explore their own ideas and is willing to put out there the complexity that is humankind. I mean, it deserves all those awards.
No, that's great. I'm thrilled that you liked it. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Great, great, great.
Yeah, yeah. And now Jenny did ask me if we were going to, I know we have, oh, wow, we really have no time.
That's okay.
There's a controversy about Mike Resnick right now.
Oh, That's right. Yeah. I don't know how embroiled he actually is in it, to be honest.
I don't think it's that much of a controversy, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He and somebody else who's well known, and I can't remember.
Let's see.
Wrote some column about, you know, kind of two old timers in the business.
Yeah, I think it's Barry Malzberg.
Okay.
Yeah, another science fiction writer.
Yeah, yep. They would write about, you know, kind of like a looking back and that kind of thing. And they did something about, if I can sum it up without sounding too shallow about it, they did a column that was talking about, oh, the cons of old and, you know, when you could have all the babes in bikinis around and, you know, or in the slinky green lady outfits and stuff. And, man, the feminist element just blasted the heck out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at it and went, I don't know why this is a controversy, because this is what happens anytime you get some group of people who, like Kariba, is so rigid, they can't let other people have their own opinions. They in the name of tolerance, they become so intolerant. And mm-hmm. that's what I've seen over and over from feminists, especially. And I can say that since I am a chick. Huh. From that time period. And interestingly, what my daughters will say often is, yeah, what those ladies don't get is they achieved what they wanted. We've got a lot of the things that the feminist party was going for, but they weren't happy with that. So they just keep going. And these young women just kind of look at them with amused tolerance and go, well, if that's what makes them happy, okay. And they get picked on by the feminists because they don't really go along with it. And you don't understand what we did. And in fact, I was at one time in one place where Hannah said, but we do, and we thank you, but it's now, not then. We're done. We have to move forward. And that person was just silenced. They were so stunned. And I think that's this whole thing is a tempest in a teapot.
Yeah,
so what? Yeah. A couple of guys were reminiscing over the old days, and that's something they liked. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Move on.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause when I read about the contract, I mean, there's some things that have happened since then that I really wish I didn't know. There was a blog post and stuff, but Resnick doesn't seem to be involved in that. You know,
he wisely is staying above.
As far as I can tell, I don't know for sure if he is or not. I'm not in the SFWA, so. But it's just like, just avoid the whole thing. But
yeah.
I haven't seen anything that I find objectionable either, so
yeah,
not from Mike Resnick anyway.
No. And the that's kind of in a sense, this book kind of gives me a new definition for rigidity. It's just well, that's the Kariba in them. You know.
Yeah
So
interesting.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
you bet. All right, so what have we got coming up next? And I'm thrilled that you liked the book. That was great, because it kind of did affect you the same way. But yeah, I loved your comments.
Oh, thank you.
Yes,
well,
welcome. It's you know, really neat.
What a great conversation. I would never have thought of some of the points you brought up. That's what I love about this.
Me too. It's fun. It's
anyway,
a good time. All right. So in a couple weeks, we're going to watch Ushpizin. Did I say it right this time?
I think. I can't remember now. It's an Israeli movie.
Uh-huh.
And this is starting our tri-annual, I guess, faith. Mm-hmm. Focus, and this is about a husband and wife in Israel, current time, during the festival of Sukkoth. Now, I probably didn't say that right, which is where they build booths and it's a harvest festival.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a light, funny movie, but it does examine deeper issues about faith.
Great.
Too.
Yeah.
So,
looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then The Hiding Place is the book mm-hmm. after that by Corrie Ten Boom, and there's nothing light about it, but it can be quite heartwarming in many, many places, especially early in the book.
Yeah.
Which is about her experience during the Holocaust.
Right, right. Okay, and then after that, I have not selected a movie yet.
I was wondering.
But I did pick a book. So a book, you know, 4 weeks after that, September 5th, is going to be World War Z.
Woo-hoo!
I mentioned that earlier. You know, I'm finding it incredibly thoughtful, and, you know, I'm really surprised by it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the level of knowledge, you know, Max Brooks must have. I mean,
right?
he's touching on all kinds of things. So
I
think it'll be really fun to talk about. So, and it's that'll be our, we've got 3 October podcasts. So that'll be our first October podcast this year.
Yes, and then, the choices for October are just killing me. It's such a rich field. I just keep changing my mind, so I'm going to wait and see.
Excellent. So, yeah, I'll get a movie picked by the next podcast.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yep, excellent. Well, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Wow, such a great book.
Oh, good deal, good deal.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, we'll see everybody in a couple weeks.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.